the UCR Podcast.
It's your lucky week because we have another one of those rare two-part episodes of the podcast. It's a long one, so I thought it might work better to break it up. Joe Satriani and Steve Vai, as you might be aware, have been touring with a new band called Satch Vai. And they also have an album taking shape that it sounds like, from talking to both of them, we're going to hear this thing sometime relatively soon. They are on tour as we speak, playing shows through the end of this month, and I wanted to share a couple of conversations that I had with Joe and Steve as they were getting ready to head out on tour. And in this episode, we will start with the conversation with Steve, since he's the first one I spoke with, and we talk about a number of different topics, including a new version of Van Halen's Jump that he had the chance to be part of for the recent FIFA World Cup, plus his ongoing collaboration with Adrian Belew, Tony Levin, and Danny Carey. You know them collectively as Beat. They have been out there for these past couple of years, celebrating the 80s era of King Crimson. And Steve also gets into his work with John Lydon and Public Image Limited in the past on a record that featured, among others, the late Ginger Baker of Cream. As always, there's a lot to get into, and you can find information on all things Steve at his website, vai.com. And make sure to get out there and see a show from the Satch Vai Band if you can. Here's our conversation with the one and only Steve Vai. Well, before we dig in the last hours, I was getting ready to talk to you. We published at Ultimate Classic Rock a story about the Coca-Cola anthem that you were involved with, you know, J Balvin and Amber Mark and yourself and Travis Barker. So I wanted to start there, man. Tell me about getting to work on Van Halen's Jump in a new way through that lens. It's super cool.
You know, it just goes to show you that you never know what's going to come across your desk. You know, I get all these amazing, wonderful little side projects that come in. I guess it's just part of being in the business for, you know, 46 years. And some of them are interesting and some of them are not really appropriate for me. But this one came in and they, you know, for the World Cup, as you know, is a tremendous event. And
for sure,
they every year they have like a theme. And usually they write one, but this year they decided to use Jump. And they asked if I'd be interested in doing the solo. So I thought, World Cup, Coca-Cola, Jump, solo, checks all the boxes. You know, I'm like, yes. And then I heard the track and I was like, wow, this is Jump, but it's not Jump, you know? They really took bold steps. And I just think it came out great. You know, a lot of times when these, within these conglomerates, there's creative people. And they presented this track. And at first I thought, wow, I mean, this is very different. But then I thought, well, it's got to be different. What are you going to do? This, you know, the same song. So I was very intrigued at what they were doing. So the track went through a lot of different iterations and changes. You know, I was kind of involved from the point where they had the basic, you know, tracks, rhythm tracks and stuff. And I, you know, I decorated it all the way through, and then they added other things and changed some stuff. So I went back and did it again, and you know, I did that about three times until it was finished. And that was, you know, pretty much how it came about.
I think that was probably a lot more fun for you than just something where you've always appreciated things that are weird or bold or however we're going to describe anything that you've been involved with. And that's always kind of a fun approach to begin with. But this also sounds like it was a lot more collaborative than some stuff where it's just like you get the call, you know, and you send your thing in and you don't hear it about it again until it comes out. So it seems like this was super cool in that regard.
Well, yeah, but they were very communicative, very transparent. And it was easy to work with them, and they were interested in really creativity. You know, the people involved, Joshua, I'm gonna have to check up on the names, but
no problem.
They were a really good group of young adults that are just at their prime, at their peak, you know. So they, what, when it was first presented to me and it was the solo for Jump, I immediately thought, eh, I don't know if I want to do that, because what do you, how do you improve that, you know? And it felt kind of side manny, you know. So then I heard the track and the whole solo section has nothing to do with the original. And I thought, okay, I'm in.
That's fantastic. So to that end, before I move on, how easy was it for you as the guy playing that to kind of find your way into it?
Well, you know, oddly enough, it wasn't that easy, because usually if people reach out to me to do something, it's not something specific that they want. Like, this is how this part goes, and please do something like this. You know, I don't do that. If people send me something, they know, okay, we don't know what we're going to get from this guy, but whatever it is, it's what it is, you know? And a lot of people have enough trust to just, you know, let me do it, because I'm not a working studio musician, you know? So when this came along, I knew that, that's what they were interested in. They were interested in what is Vi going to do here? You know, we don't know, but it's okay. But even so, it's such a big track. And I mean, this stuff gets branded and it just travels the world, you know, powerfully, you know, and all television, radio, everything, you know. So that's a responsibility there for me not to, you know, not to be too Vi, you know. So I had to think relatively accessibly, which I do. I always think my music is accessible.
Oh, man, let's shift gears here. There we go. Okay. Yeah. Well, shifting gears here, how did dancing sort of take shape? It's been really fun to watch the journey that you and Joe have taken with this music as we've been hearing this song by song. In this case, with dancing, how did you land on reinterpreting that song with Joe?
Well, that's an interesting story, too. Now, it was a kind of thing where once Joe and I started with the idea that we're going to be doing a record together and we got to start submitting ideas. I had a ton of ideas, but also I had this track that I just fell in love with in the 80s by Paolo Contes, this Italian kind of pop star. And this track got under my skin and I just couldn't let it go for decades. And I always kind of fantasized about doing a dual guitar version of it. And it has nothing to do, on one level, it doesn't have much to do with rock and roll. You know, it's a more of a Latin inspired kind of a groove track. But I'm always looking for something that's just a little unexpected, but is still good, you know, still works. And so it was an eclectic kind of an idea that I just kept on the back burner. And when the gig came up with Joe, I sent it to Joe and I said, you know, I have this idea. I don't know, you know, see what you think. And it you know, working with Joe, it's very transparent. It's very honest. It's very practical. So, you know, I sent them the track. So if he was to say, no, you know, this isn't going to work, I'd be like, okay, great. You know, let's see what else we got. You know, I don't. And that did happen on various tracks, you know, from both of us, you know, but it was a joint understanding. It was interesting to see how close we resonated on ideas, because we've worked together, but not like this, you know, not where we're forensically building songs and discussing pick, you know, movements and stuff. And it was so much melody and solos and these kinds of things. So when I sent him Dancing, I kind of thought, well, you know, maybe he'll be interested, maybe he won't. But he wrote back and he said, He goes, I don't know what I'm going to play on this, but I trust your insanity, you know. So we went for it. And then when it came time to, so basically I built the track with, I took, there's originally, there was horn parts, and I made them all guitars. There's like 12 or 17 guitar tracks doing these horn parts. And, yeah, and then we, you know, it's the process of editing some more. And that's what Joe and I did to the track until we finally got it where it was. And Eric Cudjoe is our co-producer, and he's very responsible for so much of the record. You know, just he was a great sounding board. He had very practical production overviews, and great guy, funny, unbelievably talented. He just takes our stuff and tweaks it, and you get it back and go, oh, did I play that? You know? So, you know, he was instrumental in the construction of everything too. So yeah, that's how it came out. And then we had released The Sea of Emotion, which was a great kind of opening track, I think, because it instrumental rock guitar. It's accessible. It's got a little bit of a, you know, a uniqueness in it. It's got Joe's incredible melodic DNA, you know, and it worked great. And then for the second track, it was an opportunity to kind of see what happens if we did something really straight ahead and very, you know, so that was, I Want to Play My Guitar. It even had vocals. The great Glenn Hughes sang. It's a great track, very straight ahead, you know, very powerful, fun. But then for the third track, when the time came, we had a track that Joe had kind of started the construction of. It's called Mayhem, and it's what you would expect. You know, it's a very driving, fast, great melody, instrumental rock, you know, just what you would expect. And so, but we had dancing, and we were just thinking, well, for a third single, do we want to, you know, keep it straight, or do we want to go a little weird, a little left of center, and release dancing? And Joe and I were just like, I don't know, you know, I mean, so we gave it to the label to decide. And they said that they felt that perhaps dancing would be a good option for this third slot, simply because it's one of these things is different than the other, you know.
At the same time, though, you guys collectively and individually have always been doing different things where it's like you never know exactly what to expect from yourself or from Joe. And I think this fits the aesthetic of that because, in a sense, sometimes you guys are doing what feel like these audio mini movies kind of things. And yeah. So it's always kind of interesting. I think what we're hearing, of course, is the end result of you guys finding the path. What's the journey that we're going to take with this song? And I think that probably for a lot of creative folks and songwriters, that's what you're trying to figure out with every song is like, what's the journey we're taking here? But it's just like this. If the average person doesn't know that this song was originally done by somebody else, I think they would not know that, just because it feels like you guys took the same path, the same journey with this one that you would any piece of music that you were working on, in this case, together.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, primarily if Joe and Steve get together to make a record, it's going to be the celebration of the rock guitar. You know,
there's going to be a guitar. Yeah.
It's really, you know, we didn't sit down and say, okay, we're going to do something completely different. Nobody's going to even recognize it. You know, like something like David Bowie would do, or, you know, like just a complete left turn. We're not those kind of animals, you know? But we did, I feel that we raised each other's bar a bit, because, you know, when you're in a creative environment like that with somebody that's so inspired, and they do something, you know, Joe would send me, I'd see the email, and I go, okay, here we go. And, you know, say, well, okay, I put this solo down. What do you think? And I'd listen. I go, geez, my God, what am I going to do? Because it's like so great and so interesting. So I have to think, okay, I got to deliver here. You know, what am I, you know, and this is the fuel for going deeper, you know, because the last thing I'm going to do is do something like he did. You know, that's not what people want. That's not what I want. You want to be pushed into your own creative potential more and more. And sometimes it takes working. Well, most of the time, the most effective way is to work with people that are monsters, you know, and Joe's a monster, you know, and it made me, it helped me to push myself into, you know, more, even more Vi-isms. So it's a great record. I think the fans are going to really kind of hear that, intertwining guitar elixir kind of thing, and the camaraderie and the melodies. So we're very excited about it.
You guys have such a long connection, so it's not like some situations where you go into this not knowing each other. So I've wondered, the fact that you guys have gone out and done a substantial amount of shows, Steve, how is that fed back into this album, if at all?
Well, naturally, the more time you spend with somebody and the more you open up, the deeper you can go on the creative level. And it with Joe and I, it started when we were kids, you know. I started taking lessons from him when I was 12, and probably for about 3 years. And by the time, you know, the last year or so, it was really just jam sessions where we would sit in his backyard with electric guitars, no amps, just back to back for hours, hours. One time we went 6 hours, and we were just these kids, you know, like, I think I was 14. And there's something very magical that happens when you're doing that, because you're not even looking at each other. You're just hearing, you have to listen, and you're forced to enter a very kind of, I feel it's a sacred environment, psychological environment, where you have to listen and you can't be thinking, you know, you have to respond. And even through that year, I saw this growth, these moments of discovery where you discover. Like, for instance, the first thing I was doing, I was just playing the scales I knew. But then I'm working with somebody that has a completely inspired ear, and he's playing melodies and stuff. So now I'm learning that you don't just do scales, you know. So this was a great, great experience. And then it's like a meditation, you know, you go deeper, and it's in the listening, and it's a very intimate connection. So that was probably the greatest training, musical training. The theory, the technique, all that was very important, but it was in the listening. This is a musician's greatest asset. It's their most creative tool. Is the ability to listen. And I always break it down into sort of two listening muscles. The first is when your attention is listening to the environment around you and you're responding. And the other listening, it kind of shares the attention. It's listening to the ideas in your head that are happening in the moment, in the rapid succession of the present moment. And that's a beautiful thing, because when you're in that zone, there's no room to think about anything else, you know. And with Joe, I'm brought there, you know, because you have to go there, you know, you can't, it's a big boy game. And learning that served me so well through my entire career. And I've had the great opportunity to play with a lot of wonderful musicians And I discovered some people know how to listen and some don't. Some people just they don't hear you. You know what I mean? When you're playing with them.
Yeah.
And you know that's okay. You know, it's part of their process. You know, part I was there. But then when you fast forward 52 years and you're doing it again with the same guy, it's really it's just I just it's wonderful. It's a blessing. You know, it feels like just like a privileged honor in life to be standing with somebody and to be able to freely exchange these creative ideas that turn into guitar playing notes. It's just great. I highly recommend it.
Before I forget about it, you talk about like the various people that you've worked with over the years, and every situation is different. And that's what's kind of fascinating looking at your discography, Steve, is you have done all this, interesting and different stuff, which is really what I think a lot of creative folks hope to do in the course of their career. One interesting entry in your discography is how you got to participate in a PIL record with John Lydon that Ginger Baker also played on. So I know it was kind
And
of a
Tony
quick experience.
Williams.
Yeah, but I know it was kind of a quick experience. It sounds like you were kind of, if I understand it correctly, in and out over the period of a couple of days. Were you ever there at the time that Ginger was there? Did you make music
No.
with Ginger at all? No. Oh, I kind of got that
No, doing
sense.
that. No, the closest I got was a couple of years later when I took an elevator ride with him. I think it was NAMM or something. And I introduced myself and I say, you know, we played on that Pill record together. And he was very, very kind, very cool, very colorful,
That's it.
and only lasted a minute.
Yeah. Well, how was
Yeah.
that experience for you working on that record, though?
I love that. That was so great. That was one of my favorites also because I didn't have to do anything, you know. I was asked onto the gig. I was on tour with Alcatraz. So I had to fly in. I could only work a half a day, two half days. I fly in half a day at Electric Lady, fly out, do a few more gigs, fly in another half a day, and fly out. So I didn't really have much time. And I didn't really know the music very well because it happened so quickly. But when I was working with Bill Laswell as producer, and I, you know, I listened to a lot of I listened to it, and then I kind of imagined guitar parts. And the funny thing to me was that you know, my lineage and heritage was very different than Lydon, but this record was very different than either of us because Bill Laswell, he's so brilliant. I mean, he was able to cast an audio impression of cultural African music, you know, and he did that by taking elements of that style. If you listen to Ginger's grooves and all, you know, they're very African inspired. So that opened up a lot of ideas for me, and it was really great fun because I had all the latitude in the world. I mean, there was one track I didn't even hear, and Bill says, "Okay, let's do it. Put a solo, put something on this song." And I said, "Okay, well, let's listen." And he said, "No, don't listen. Just play." So I'm like, "Okay, I know where he's going," and he left the room. He hit play and record and left the room. And I'm like, okay, game on, you know, and perhaps all those years of training as a youth with Joe in listening helped me because when I was finished, he comes in, he goes, well, how'd it go? And I said, I think it actually went pretty good. So that, you know, things like that happened. And then on the last day, Lydon came in and he was just great. You know, he's John Lydon, and he listens to the whole thing. And I don't know what to expect because he's a tough guy. He's really tough, and if he speaks his mind, so I didn't know. I was afraid if he didn't like it, I might get beat up or something. You know,
yeah.
But he listened to the whole thing, and then he just goes, "It's fucking great, man."
Highest praise from John Lydon.
I know. And then we went out to dinner and had a great time.
You just seem like somebody that has always, you probably take interesting things from an experience like that, that ultimately probably helped you creatively as you continue to make your way in your own career. You probably took something interesting from that, that ultimately inspired you in different ways as you moved forward.
Well, that happens inevitably with everything you do. You're always taking something from something. You know, you're never the same, even from one moment to the next. And something like that Pill Project, I'm sure it had some kind of influence on me. It absolutely did. You know, I don't know if I could point it out and say, well, I remember because I did that, I did this, but it's in there. And that holds true for everybody.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. As far as the tour dates that are coming up, you guys both seem pretty stoked that you've got Animals as Leaders coming out with you guys. Like, great band.
Yeah. Yeah. I've had the good fortune of working with Tosin. When I first heard his music, you know, it was very nice to see the emergence of the underground guitar technique evolution. And it started, as far as I could tell, around 2010, you know, where I started to really see, maybe 2000-ish, after the 90s, where these young players were just starting to take the technique on the instrument to another whole level. And it's just part of the human spirit that ignores trends. It doesn't care about trends. It doesn't care what's accessible or what's popular. It just says, I want to do this. And then you get these kids listening to what's going on around them and starting from there. And their whole social structure was different than the previous generation. And their whole idea of where to take the instrument is different. So I started seeing these incredible players emerging. And what I noticed, because I know, if you want to be a virtuoso type player, you know, you just have to practice your ass off. You have to practice and practice and practice. It doesn't mean you're going to be a great musician. It'll mean you'll be a technician. Unless you have some kind of whatever your melodic brain muscles are able to conjure, it will flow into your technique development. But it's very rare for me, and this is just my personal taste, which doesn't mean anything. It's just another opinion. I see the evolution of guitar technique phenomenally, but I don't hear the evolution of harmonic melodic theories. It's all the same stuff. It's rare to hear if Alan Holdsworth, you know, there's somebody that the harmonic evolution is off the hook. So in all that, I'm watching and listening, and then I hear Animals as Leaders. And that Animals, out of the whole batch, and I have great appreciation for all of them, but Animals and maybe Pliny, that's when I started hearing some melodic harmonic ideas that were tickling my inner brain, you know? And that's hard to do because I'm a snob. Yeah. So that's one of the things that Tosin was doing that was so fantastic. And I'm also really interested in rhythm. And had all those Zappa transcriptions I used to do, where there was a lot of focus on creating bizarre notation, rhythmic notations for things. So I became fascinated earlier on, even through high school and Berkeley, with subdivisions, odd meters, polymeter, polyrhythms, you know, all this kinds of high information music. So when I heard Animals, I'm listening to the rhythm also, and I'm like, I'm okay. You know, I can hear some pretty complex things and kind of understand what's going on. But I was listening to this stuff and I'm trying to figure out what it is. And I can't figure it out. I'm listening. Of course, at first you listen for just the music, the impact. But then you go, well, what's going on in there? You know, and you start listening and finding dead ends. Like, I can't figure it out. So finally, when I get on tour with Tosin, because Tosin did the Generation X, and he's a dear friend. He's just, I love Tosin. And I said to him, I go, dude, you know, what are you doing here? Like, what are you and the drummer, what are you thinking? And he just goes, I don't know. We just play. So I'm like, oh, fine, you know. But they just play, but they know what they're doing. But they don't necessarily, or Tosin didn't necessarily explain it like, well, this is a bar of 2316, and then we go to a bar of this, and then we do that. It's all feel. But with his unique playing style, even just his playing style is enough. But it's accompanied with real high quality melodic ideas and rhythmic ideas. So having him on this tour with us, it's diverse, you know, because our music is very different. But I think it's a great package, and I'm so happy that they're doing it.
It really is. You guys always seem to put thought into, again, both collectively and individually, who you guys take out. And I think fans appreciate that because it ends up being a good night. But to circle back to the record, it just seems like you guys obviously have a wealth of material. I think it's probably been interesting distilling it down. When do you think fans are going to hear this record? And if there's, I guess, overage as far as, you know, too many songs for the record that you're going to put out, do you have kind of a little bit of consolation in your mind that, like, this could form the next record? Are you already thinking towards the next record? Like, how do you kind of, like, I guess, segment all of that out? Because when you, as you say, like, you guys have been throwing a lot of material at each other. Some gets accepted, some gets rejected. But ultimately, you, as with every record that you make, you wind up with a big stack of material. Eventually, depending on how disciplined you are or aren't, you have a big stack of recorded material. And then you have to figure out what's the album that comes out of all this.
Yeah. Well, usually if you leave the cooperative components to create themselves, they usually do. For instance, Joe and I, we in the past, we didn't plan on forming a band, but we kind of knew it's probably inevitable, you know? But when it happened, it just happened. It happened very organically, smoothly, transparently, and beautifully. So that's a great move forward plan. Only do what feels right when the time feels right, you know? And so I it's hard to talk about the future. I don't, you know, I tell you thoughts and ideas and goals and stuff, but we have no idea what's going to happen. But in the process of making this music, yeah, we had a lot of songs. I think we had like 18 tracks.
Wow.
And most of them were completed pretty much. And some of them were just like demos that we each made and we said, you know. So the one of the things that Joe and I just without discussion stuck by was when we both agreed on something, then it was the right thing. You know, if one of us had a feeling about it that, you know, then it was no question. I would never try to talk him into liking a song. Why? You know, or making a demand or something. You work together. And when you both go, Aha, that's it. That's what. So we could have had 17 song record, but there were songs like, So will they be reworked in the future? Who knows? But the making of a song for me with Joe Satriani is a pleasure. It's fun. It's creative. It's something that I don't know if it's possible to do in the way we do it with anybody else because of our connection and our similarity, our likes, our, these kinds of things. So yeah, we thought, wouldn't it be nice if we continued something like this in the future? But we both know that it just has to happen organically, and organically means you just know, hey, let's do this now. This is just this feels like the right thing. And you find yourself doing it without any excuses or stress or agenda, it's purely, I wouldn't say purely because there's other considerations, but for the most part, it's just a creative endeavor. I don't know
Yeah,
if I answered
that
the
makes sense.
question, but
No, yeah, absolutely. I guess the only part of it you necessarily did not hit, potentially didn't hit, would be when will folks hear the album?
Good question. Well, we missed our December deadline because we've both been juggling impossible touring schedules because I did my whole solo 19-month tour. And then, Joe had his, he was out with Elephants of Mars. And then he got involved with Sammy. And then we were doing G3. And then we're doing Satriani Vi. And then I'm doing Beat. And then he's doing Sammy. And then I'm going back to Beat. He's going back to Sammy. Right now he's with Sammy. And we get together for Satch Vi. And then I go to Beat. And he goes back to Sam, it's this kind of thing. So, unfortunately, we missed our deadline to have the record out when the tour starts. But we're pretty confident or hopeful that it'll be out, not sure, not long after the tour starts. So, I'm thinking and I'm hoping, but don't hold me to this because it's not my job to really know.
Sure, that makes sense.
March. Yeah,
So
I think end of March maybe or April.
you two have popped up some interesting places over the years. How did you and Joe end up playing on Feed My Frankenstein?
Well, somebody must have been whispering in Alice Cooper's ear, or he just decided because Joe and I were pretty hot at that time. And I know that Alice enjoys inviting great guitar players onto his music. So we both just got the invitation.
Fantastic. Was it fun?
Yeah, it was good in the fact that, in the sense that I got the track and it already had Joe's on it. So I was able to take what, it's been a long time, but I think he did a solo, then I did a solo. And then there's this big outro thing. So I'm always about how can I arrange this? How can I like do something that's not just an improv, so I was able to like double and harmonize his some of his soloing stuff. So like I think gave it a cool kind of energy.
Yeah, for sure. You mentioned Beat. I had a chance to see the show here in Cleveland at the Agora. So cool to see all of you guys playing together. I think I've talked with you guys individually about this before the shows really happened, but at this point, now that you guys have done a bunch of shows, have you guys talked about music? How much has there been any sort of that kind of conversation as far as like making music together?
Well, that's of course we've thought about it and we talked about it. And I don't rule out anything. But frankly, in Beat, I feel like my role is that of a dutiful soldier. I am there to do my best to play Robert Fripp's guitar parts so that the fans can enjoy the music. And get a little, Yankee Doodle Vine-ness, you know. Now that music is King Crimson music, and it's the brainchild of Adrian and Robert. So if all of a suddenly Steve Vai starts, writing music, it's not King Crimson. Whereas it's actually a King Crimson band. So how do you, negotiate that in your head? Because my first concern is, well, not first concern, but it's the fans, The fans of this band, King Crimson, are very fe they're fiercely su supportive and loyal, and like any other focused genre listening audience, they're snobby. I'm a snob. That every community has its snobs. Classical community, blues community, Jesus. I mean, the blues community has some of the biggest snobs. So I get it. It's the human condition. Ours is best. Fuck you. But of course that's a rough way of putting it, but not everybody feels that way, but most do. And especially in religion and politics, but we won't go there. But music comes it's the same comes from the same place. So with Beat, I was so surprised and so actually pleasantly surprised to see how supportive the fans are of that music. You know what I mean? They really are. I mean, they love it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I know because I'm one of them, not as intense as a traditional kind of a fan, but so the idea of new music is it's a whole different it would be a different band. It would be different all around. Now, having said that, similar to the way Joe and I came together for the band, meaning the cooperative components arrived when they were ready. And we recognized them and organically and seamlessly floated into it. If that happens with Beat, then it happens.
So everything you've laid out, Steve Vai has a lot going on. What else is Steve Vai working on here for 2026 and beyond? What
Oh,
else is on your list, I guess?
yeah. I have a couple of things sitting on the shelf that I've been holding on to until all of this is over. And it'll probably all of my touring with the Beat and Joe and all that stuff will probably be done by Christmas. So I have a solo acoustic vocal record that I'm
Cool.
still working on. I got to finish that. When I kicked off my tour in May of 22, I re also recorded 3.5 hours of my orchestral music. I love composing. I've composed since I was a kid before I even was playing the guitar. It's a guilty pleasure. It's totally inaccessible type music. It's a playground for my imagination. And it's something that I always wanted to do, and I saved up a lot of money. And because recording orchestras in a studio is expensive.
Indeed, yeah.
And especially 3.5 hours. And I recorded for 3 weeks with the Metropole Orchestra in Holland, and then with 2 weeks with the Tampere Philharmonic in Tampere, Finland. And so I have 4 hours of orchestral music sitting on the shelf, and that I want to get to getting some of that out. About half of it is probably accessible to instrumental type listeners, and then half of it is these huge compositions that I don't know what to say
Your
about.
Vinus comes out.
So then there's a I have a one more video from Inviolate, which is
Nice.
my last solo record, sitting on the shelf. I mean, I had such a great run with videos for that album. You know, I did Candle Power. Well, this was all during lockdown, you know. Sandman Cloud Mist is one of my favorite. Knapsack, the one-handed stuff, and Teeth of the Hydra, Little Pretty. I mean, in my little world, that was so fulfilling. But there's one more, Greenish Blues. And it's sitting on the shelf. I just have to finish it. And I'll do that next year. And in July of 2027, there's a couple of concerts that are happening in The Hague in Holland, and it's more orchestral music. I'll be composing. Cool. Yeah, I'm composing a violin solo for one of the greatest violinists in Spain. I'm composing a violin concerto, saxophone, a quartet, saxophone quartet, a piece for the Metropole with rock band and orchestra, and then two huge symphonic pieces. And to compose, it's really a, for me, it requires undisturbed time. After this tour, even while I'm on tour with Beat and Joe, I'll be composing for this midsummer 27.
Yeah.
But then once I get back after that, it's 14-hour undisturbed days to compose, to get ready. And then I have right after that is, you may have seen an announcement recently for a cruise. It's a riverboat cruise. It's a very high-end, exclusive.
Yeah.
You know, when it came across my desk, I was looking. I always wanted to do one of those. I know all those locations; they're gorgeous. That's what, if I could spend the summer anywhere, it's in Europe, and especially these riverboats, because you get all these amazing excursions. So this company contacted me and asked if I would host a riverboat cruise. And at first, you got to think about these things. It's kind of expensive. And, you know, I don't know if my fans are that kind of, have that kind of wealth. I'm sure many of them do, but it's a life experience. And I just started thinking about it and I'm like, yeah, I am so into it. And we made the announcement the other day, and pretty soon tickets were going to go on, be available like in a couple of days. And, the first announcement was to just see if there was any interest. And it was overwhelming. The interest was overwhelming. So now they're going to be launching the ability to purchase. And I think that's going to be fun. But after that, I'm going off grid for a while, because I'll be
understandably.
Yeah. And we just moved after 46 years of living in Los Angeles. We just moved. And we live in San Diego, actually. And this
cool.
Seeing my new studio.
Yeah.
I still have to work on it. You know, but it's actually bigger than the Harmony Hut.
That's a great space.
Yeah, it's really great. It's really great. And, I need to get home and be a husband and a father and a, you know, all these things.
That makes sense.
And get the house together.
I'm going to end with just a few things with Eat'em and Smile turning 40. Can you give us fly on the wall experience as far as how Yankee Rose came together?
Well, you know, when you're sequestered in a basement and you're doing stuff, sometimes you have no idea what the overall end impact is going to be in the world stage. So I got together with Dave and the guy, you know, the band in the basement for like a year, you know, and it was fun writing music. I would usually write something, or somebody would write something, bring it in. Dave would listen. If he liked it, we continued. And if it got completed, he would write lyrics to it. So when I came in with Yankee Rose, I just had this idea for this talking guitar part, you know. And Ted Templeman, man, he was all over it. He loved it. And Dave got a big kick out of it. So that's how we kicked it off. And it was, like I said, it's interesting because you're working on something and you don't know what's happening out there until the video came out. And, you know, making the video and all, it was a whole different experience. First of all, you're coming from, you know, a van, you know, traveling around basically with Alcatraz and Winnebago to play to 100 people. And all of a sudden you're in an arena with people literally screaming so loud that it's frightening. And, I mean, it wasn't frightening, you know what I mean? When we shot the video, it was fantastic because I'd never seen a stage that big in my life. Matter of fact, the amount of cans that we had, lighting cans, actually was in the Guinness Book of World Record. The most lighting cans on a, I don't know, crazy stuff. But it was just how the flow of things went. They went so fast. And like where I would have to like basically save up to buy a cool pair of pants, they would come in with racks and racks of these outrageous 80s clothes, you know, spandex and sequins and all that. And back then that was kind of like, you know, the thing. And it was like a opportunity to just act like a rock star and do all those, wear the craziest clothes you could wear, do crazy things with your hair and just run around as fast as you can on stage and throw the guitar all over the place. It was just one of those kind of rock moments. And I ate it up because I knew that it was transient. It wasn't going to last. It was going to come and go, and I wasn't going to be interested in chasing it. So it happened, and it was great. And that whole Yankee Rose thing, just then with the video and the way it hit MTV and was so popular, it was just like really cool to be a part of that whole thing.
You kind of laid out the collaborative process with Dave and the band a little bit. Our editor wondered, does Dave write riffs? Was that ever part of it?
No, not usually. He, you know, he left that to me or whoever's playing their part. He might occasionally chime in with something. I remember he told me, you know, Jamie's Crying.
Yeah.
That was him. He sang that to Edward. And also the other one, I think it was Ain't Talking About Love. Mm-hmm. So I guess he does do that kind of thing. And I can't, he may have done that with us, but I can't give you a definite example. I don't recall.
The other thing our editor kind of wondered is, obviously Dave has this big personality. How much would he shift modes and have like a serious linear type of conversation?
David Lee Roth was David Lee Roth at all times. Now, of course, people have different moods, and living with somebody, you experience all their moods. But for the most part, he was intense. David Lee Roth was intense. I mean, the man, very professional. You may not, you know, a lot of people don't know. They think they know Dave, you know, but it was intense. If you had to be at the studio at 10, you better be there at 9:30. You know what I mean? And he works really hard. And when it comes time to like physical stuff, I mean, he would always only hire the best trainers and he would do the most extreme things. But for the most part, he was always funny. He had real wit, really witty, very intelligent. He speaks like 5 languages. But he was David Lee Roth, you know? So I communicated with him great. I think I did. We were actually, I think it's safe to say we were actually friends. We would do things together. But what was the question again? I want to make sure I answer
Oh,
it.
yeah, it was just basically Dave has this big personality. He wondered like how much would he shift modes and
Yeah.
have a serious
No, no,
linear
no. It,
conversation.
that
Yeah.
kind of big personality that people have in private, it may not be animated, but it translates into something else. So like holding court, when speaking, or even if there's three people around. Vibrant personalities have to hold court. And the more intense they are, the less of an opportunity you have to speak.
For sure. Yeah.
But he was
Well, just
always
your,
funny
yeah.
and always expected excellence.
Just generally, what kind of sticks with you about that time working on the songs that eventually become that album 40 years later? What is interesting to you about that album that perhaps you didn't take stock of at the time you were doing it? Like kind of the big 10,000 foot view 40 years later.
What a great opportunity it was to taste that world and to be a part of it. But also, we look back at our lives and what we were thinking at particular periods in our life and how that thinking has served us today when we look back. And I remember my feeling at the time was, these are great, as far as the record itself, I didn't have to be Edward. I didn't have to play his parts. And I thought, I know I didn't recognize it at the time, but I have, like many musicians, a particular frame of mind when I'm playing, when I'm thinking of what's the most appropriate thing here. Where am I in all of this? That's a question that a lot of musicians may ask themselves when they're building something. And when I look back at that thought in my head, because I knew I really needed to infuse everything I was doing with me, whatever I was, I didn't, you don't really recognize these things. But when I look back, I always seem to have been reaching for something technically over the top. Something that had a melodic sensibility. And I don't know why, but I've always gone there. I think one of my strengths is my quirkiness. You can hear a lot of quirk in that record. And I think one of the things that was cool about it was that Dave's kind of quirky too. So I remember thinking, I got to do this, and then I'm going to do this. And then I gotta, okay, all right, I got this. Okay, I gotta do this. This is crazy. This is silly. I gotta do that. I'm not gonna do that. That's too straight ahead. So that was a way of thinking. So you asked me, when I look back, that way of thinking and the way it flowered into Eat 'Em and Smile, that's a big surprise now. Because when I from another perspective, when I hear some of that stuff, I can think, God, where did I get the balls to do that? And then I think, yeah, it was when you were sitting there getting excited about the parts. Like I remember when I wrote Big Trouble and I kind of heard the solo. I knew what I was going to do. And you never know what people are going to think. So you can't. I don't count that in. I can o you can only use your own source of enthusiasm as a barometer, So I wait until there's this feeling of, oh, yeah, there it is. There it is. You know what I mean? That's what
For sure.
everybody is waiting for when they're being creative. But I can't move forward unless I have that, unless I get that feeling, Now, what that means to some, what is interesting and creative to me, it may not resonate with anybody else, but what are you going to go with? You got to go with what's exciting to you. So I just thought, well, I'm really going to excite myself, and maybe there's others that'll get it, but I don't know. So that process of creating, I just really made it exciting for myself. And when I hear it now, it sounds exciting. I'm so happy that that was captured. And I was a pretty wild kind of a, 24-year-old also, And I just was filled with piss and vinegar, and I was ready to, yeah, at that age, you're ready to take on the world, And you want to show everybody what you got. Am I going to be like, what? This is what I got, like Edward, Nobody wants that, They want to see who you are. So I was really happy later when I listened back to that record and I said, that's me.
That's always a good feeling if you can step away and come back to the record and have that for sure.
Yeah, and the contrast is when you don't do that and you placate your fears by doing things that you believe must fit in. For me, it's never been as rewarding
Yeah.
as being my quirky self.
That's a great place to close. Keep being your quirky self. We expect that from you. So thank you
Thanks,
always,
brother.
Steve. It's always fun to chop it up musically with you, man.
Oh, you got it, Matt. Thank you. You're a great writer, and I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Take care, man. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
We've reached the end of another episode of the UCR podcast. It is Matt Wardlaw. We appreciate you listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please rate and review wherever you are listening and hit subscribe so that you'll receive future episodes of the podcast from Ultimate Classic Rock.